You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the FEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the FEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 11 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I am Tristan Caracino.
And this week, we are not coming to you live from Scenic Boulevard Park. I am coming to you from my hotel room here in New York City.
And I'm in beautiful Renton, Washington, home of the Seahawks. It's the bi-coastal Fabulous Pelton Cast.
That is a first. Yes, this is the first time we're doing it via Skype instead of in person. And instead of being out touring New York City, which I have never been to before in my life, I am taking time to record this podcast. Which
you're talking to me on the phone. Well, hopefully it'll be a shorter version of the Fabulous Pelton Cast this week.
I think our listeners hope that as well.
Everyone does. So anyway, lots of stuff to talk about. But first, do you want to talk about the trip that you're on right now?
Yeah, as we discussed last week, I started out in Bristol, arrived there Sunday night after traveling throughout the NFL Sunday and having to follow the Seahawks game from 35,000 feet. And then spent a day and a half at rookie camp, making this transition to being an employee of ESPN instead of a contractor. And
still a rookie, though.
Still a rookie, yeah. It was actually kind of amusing. There was someone who I knew a little bit who was there, has worked for ESPN for, I think, maybe at least a decade, but moved from, you know, contractor to was full-time before and then became a contractor and went back to full-time. So she was at rookie camp despite being, you know, very experienced at ESPN. It was pretty amusing. But after that, I headed down, took the train to New York City and was at last night's Knicks-Pacers game.
Oh, really? Well, I want to hear about rookie camp first. I think people might want to hear an insider's view. You are an ESPN insider of what goes on at ESPN rookie training camp.
Well, it's really, you know, there's a sports theme. Everything's is the rookie camp would indicate. There's a play-by-play for the day and things like that.
Your lunch is like touchdown chicken tenders. Home run applesauce.
I don't think they have quite those creative names in the cafeteria, although Monday was barbecue themed because the Carolina Panthers were the home team on Monday Night Football. There's your inside information on ESPN.
Really? Wait, they do the cafeteria does themed foods based upon Monday Night Football?
Yeah, so I had a pulled pork and mac and cheese sandwich, which
wow,
is as good as it sounds.
I guess usually that distracts from how bad the Monday Night Football games are.
Not last week, and definitely not the upcoming week, although we'll...
No, actually, Monday Night Football is some of the best coming up. I was thinking about that. But Seahawks-Saints being on Monday Night Football is really exciting for ESPN.
But really, a lot of it is your standard new company orientation, policies, learning the computer system, things like that. It's just that the uniqueness is at ESPN, when they're talking about the security, they can play the ads from This Is SportsCenter, the joke about security on the campus. So that's a little bit different.
That's pretty cool. And who did you see when you were there this time? I'm always curious.
It was not as exciting in that regard, I would say. You know, we walked around the radio office and were able to watch Colin Cowherd live recording a show. Saw Mike Golic over there. Let's see, Trey Wingo, I think, was working out when we went and saw the fitness, the gym on campus. But actually, my biggest star encounter was here in New York City last night.
Oh, really?
After the game, I was saying hello to Frank Vogel, the coach of the Pacers, who I used to work for. And also there was Stephen A. Smith, so I got introduced.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Larry Legend.
No, he was not, as far as I can tell, in town, which is too bad. I was really kind of hoping for that.
So I saw hang out, rub elbows with Larry Bird.
I saw Kevin Pritchard, the KP1 to my KP2, but he was the only member of Pacers management around.
Well, how is Frank Vogel doing? Good? In good spirits, I would imagine.
Yeah, after the game, he was in very good spirits.
It's like your trip. It's like the trip of more Twitter followers than you, I feel. when you're around us in Seattle, you have by far the most Twitter followers. And then you go to ESPN and you hang out with Frank Vogel and everybody's bigger than you.
Well, I don't think Frank is on Twitter, but yes, it changes the dynamic a little bit. And last night, really a who's who in terms of NBA media. All the national columnists were out to see the Knicks and the Pacers, the rematch of last year's playoff series. And, you know, the Pacers, the hottest team in the NBA right now, I think, other than maybe the Blazers.
And so what did you think about the game? Any takeaways?
It was kind of a terrible game for three quarters
Yes.
and became a really entertaining game in the fourth quarter. And the whole time I expected the Pacers to win, to be honest with you.
Really?
I said at halftime that my line was Pacers minus eight, and they almost got there with the benefit of overtime. Knicks should have won it, obviously, in regulation, up three with 8 seconds left, but Paul George gets fouled, and the Pacers kind of dominated overtime from there.
So I left work because I was still working while the game was happening, and I saw that it was close and went to Mecca in the area, the local bar, to watch the very end of the game. And I don't know about that foul that Paul George drew, but it looked pretty questionable to me. And then I really thought that Carmelo was going to hit a shot on that ensuing possession. And it looked like there was probably more contact on Carmelo on the following possession than there was on George on the three foul.
From where I was, I thought for sure he was going to score. I was kind of surprised David West didn't help more, but it looked like a pretty easy shot for Melo, and just one of those ones that didn't go down.
Well, so that was a nice game for your for your stats for the computer.
Yeah, it was very useful for that. Did not get any comments on Chaney from any Knicks fans or members of the organization, sadly. Mike Woodson did not recognize me out in the audience.
That would be very strange.
Yes, no. My mom was really convinced that I was in danger from the Knicks organization.
That members of the Knicks are going to murder you.
I think maybe just rough me up.
Rough you up, okay. Take you up back. Give you the business. I don't think that happens that often to NBA
I
writers.
don't believe so. There's not a long history of that. She also has a very interesting perspective on the safety of New York City in general. So I was amazed that I
She
survived.
has the perspective of the 80s, pre-Giuliani New York City.
Yeah, I'm a little amazed that I managed to successfully ride the subway yesterday because I thought that that would be too confusing for me. I couldn't figure out the water machine at ESPN. Had to get help with that. So,
Hey, Trey Wingo.
yeah,
He's like, you click the little button in the back and then you push it down. You think you rode the subway though? How exciting.
did. Yeah, very authentic New York experience.
I sound like such a rube. I've never been to New York City.
I felt like I was just gonna be like the guy off the turnip truck, but within a half hour here, I was already jaywalking like a veteran. So,
Really? You jaywalked because you were in New York City?
yeah, I mean, when in Rome.
Wow, because you refused to jaywalk in Seattle.
Well, first off, you're in danger of actually getting ticketed in Seattle. That's happened to many people I know. But second off, the thing that bothers me, and obviously this does happen, did see this, I didn't do it myself, is people that just run into the street when there's a car coming. You see that a lot in the U District.
Yeah, all the time.
But if there's nobody coming, you're just going to get run over otherwise here. So you kind of have to adapt.
Well, look at you. Growing up over there in the big city.
Yeah, so I've ticked several things off the life goals list.
Jaywalking was on there.
No, I've done that before. Come on. But going to the garden, which was awesome. They just renovated it, so it's much nicer. Apparently, it used to be kind of a dump under and kind of behind the scenes, but now it's very nice, and it's awesome because it's an enormous arena, but it feels really intimate as compared to like the Staples Center, which is just cavernous and empty. So that was a lot of fun. And then also I ate at a Tim Hortons. I had a
Oh, Tim Hortons. That's a Canadian restaurant, right?
yeah, they have it, but also in the northern United States. So they had one in Penn Station. So I made got a donut there.
It's a donut place?
Yeah. It's their Dunkin' Donuts, basically.
Okay, so you've been talking a lot about Dunkin' Donuts.
Which
And
I
I really, really take offense to this about how Dunkin' Donuts is better than the donuts that we have on the West Coast.
I'm not saying it's better, but it's more ubiquitous than. There's not a ubiquitous chain in Seattle.
Okay, it doesn't matter if there's a ubiquitous chain.
Well,
The
it's the.
quality of the donuts is still very low at Dunkin' Donuts, right?
It's better than what you would get at, like, a grocery store or something like that, which is, I'm not in downtown Seattle that often. I don't have a lot of alternatives out where I am.
All right. I was taking offense to this while you kept talking about Dunkin' Donuts. It's like, who cares if they have a Dunkin' Donuts? Some terrible chain of donuts. We got Top Pot, Voodoo in Portland, and Mighty O. We got good donuts around here.
Yeah, which is why we probably don't eat it. Do you remember when they used to have Dunkin' Donuts here when we were kids?
I do. I don't remember it being anything spectacular.
I don't know that we ever went, but I do remember the one at on First Avenue down in Burien.
That sounds about right. And so you're going back to the garden tonight? Are those games there?
Tonight and tomorrow night, the University of Washington Huskies are participating in the 2K Sports Classic tonight against Indiana. a game that I do not feel good about their chances in whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't think you should. Since we last talked, the Huskies had a narrow victory over Eastern, is that correct?
Well, they lost to UC Irvine. That was after our most recent podcast.
And that Irvine game, so you were there. I was watching it on TV. It kind of felt like in the first half that the Huskies were controlling the game, and then all of a sudden, his name is Mamadou Ndiaye, correct?
Yes, who I wrote about yesterday on Insider.
He is insane. He's 7'6" freshman who, for some reason, plays at UC Irvine. He's a top 100 recruit, definitely going to the NBA.
Yeah, probably going to be a first round pick. He's got an 8-foot-1 wingspan. He can basically touch the rim. I didn't see this, but he can basically touch the rim without jumping whatsoever. So that's just insane to see that on a Big West opponent. And yeah, he completely just changed the game at both ends because you can't like double team off of him. It's a guaranteed layup if he gets the ball around the basket.
Well,
And
especially with the Huskies without Jarreau too, and no height either.
yeah, I mean, Jarreau really hurt because they also have an athletic power forward who carved the Huskies up nearly as much as Ndiaye did. So the combination of that was not so good.
I was impressed with Ndiaye. I'm just kind of shocked. It seems like the Huskies always end up in the preseason playing those smaller schools who have like one big star. Like they played Nate Wolters a couple years ago, and then he just dominated the game.
Yeah, Orlando Johnson a few years ago when he was at, I think, UCSB.
So it seems like they always end up playing those players. But I was impressed with Mamadou Ndiaye. It didn't, I mean, it was a bad loss losing to UC Irvine at home, but seeing him play was pretty exciting.
Exactly, yeah. And it may look better if they actually figure out how to use him and keep playing like they did in the second half of that game.
So what are you thinking for Indiana tonight?
You know, Indiana has also struggled early in this season. They're undefeated, but they had a tough had a couple close games. I think LIU Brooklyn and even their exhibition against a D2 team. Apparently the game started with they were on the wrong side of a 13-2 run.
Wow.
So, but they have a really good freshman, Noah Vonleh, who is probably going to carve the Huskies up inside because again, they just don't have like true power forwards on the roster right now. And a really good point guard, Yogi Ferrell. So the exciting thing about this tournament is going to be the point guard play. There's Nigel Williams-Goss had a great game against Eastern and looks to be very much the real deal. There's Yogi Ferrell at Indiana, who's off to a terrific start to the season, or he's off to a decent start to the season. Shabazz Napier at UConn's off to a really good start to the season. So you're going to want to watch the point guards. I don't think Boston College, who the Huskies would play in all likelihood if they lost tonight. I don't know if they have a good point guard, though.
You don't know if they have a good point guard. Yeah, I was impressed with Nigel Williams-Goss seeing him play for the first time. He goes to that floater so often. It's kind of a surprising play for a young player like that to have a really good floater, and he hits it most often also.
He's really just very polished, and you know I think that worried some people because he was similar to the way Abdul Gaddy was described. Especially, you know, he's not super quick; he plays at a controlled pace. And but you know he's got, I'd say, he's a little bit more aggressive than Gaddy was. I think that's what separates him, and he's kind of a natural leader in a way that Gaddy wasn't. So, yeah, he has not been the issue, I wouldn't say.
He definitely didn't look lost. I mean, Abdul Gaddy, if I remember his freshman year, he was 17 years old too, right? He looked lost basically every game his freshman year. I know that he started and it's kind of like, this is our five-star recruit because he looks like he's never played basketball before. And I definitely don't get that perspective from Nigel Williams-Goss. I agree that he looks polished. He seems like he's ready to play right away. And again, having that floater, it's a pretty veteran play or a veteran shot.
Yeah, and you know, everyone I talked to about him over the summer just raved about him, and so far, you know, he's done nothing to dissuade that.
He's living up to the hype. So tonight playing Indiana, I mean, obviously, we talked about this before, about how the one team that I really want the Huskies to beat is UConn. So part of potentially beating Indiana, and the goal there is the chance to play UConn tomorrow and have another shot at them to make up for all the previous losses.
Well, we're going to play them either way, so that's the
It's
point.
true. It would be nice to have two shots at them, though.
Yeah, I mean, the more shots, the better, because it's really more opportunities for them to deal as heartbreaking, devastating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really bizarre that the two toughest losses of the entire time we've been Husky fans have both come to the same team.
They've been pretty bad. So they beat us in the NCAA tournament in 1988. Was that the year?
Yeah, it was 98.
with Khalid Alami and Rip Hamilton. And then we played them, if you recall, the following preseason.
That's true.
And Jake Voskal was, I believe, their star player then.
They still had generally the same guys from the year before.
I know Khalid El-Amin was on that team also, so.
You know, I'd have to look up, but that was supposed to be a pretty good game. I think, you know, UW was expected to build on that success and then just got demolished in that
game. Yeah, they beat the crap out of us.
Center in Chicago, I think.
So, that's three times that was another, it was a devastating loss in a different way, but it was still devastating because I went into it so excited about this rematch with UConn.
Yeah, and they just lowered expectations for that.
It crushed us. So that wasn't great. So the opportunity to play UConn is what I'm most excited about. And obviously cheering for them to beat Indiana, especially because I can't recall a time that they've played Indiana. Can you?
No, that's a pretty unique matchup. So that's going to be fun. It's not obviously the same Indiana team that was number one to start last season. They've still got some very good talent. And it seems like I think they're going to have a lot of fans here. I saw one of the Hoosiers players and then some other fans when I was walking around a little bit yesterday.
Well, and also that combo with if you could go to the Pacers game last night, were there many Pacers fans there?
Not really.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, I guess I'm not surprised by that. But if you could have gone to the Pacers game last night and then see Indiana today, that's kind of an interesting combo.
Yep, it definitely is. You know, the one thing I was considering going back to the UConn matchup, which game of those two games was more devastating? And I really feel like it was the Brandon Roy, the 2006 game, because if, you know, in 98, the Huskies were actually not that good of a team and would have been demolished by North Carolina in the Elite Eight had they made it there. But in 2006, mm-hmm. It really feels like we were that close to a Final Four trip.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not even close. The next round waiting for us would have been George Mason. So the Huskies were the 5 seed, I believe, and UConn was the 1 seed. So if you take down UConn, you basically become the 1 seed in that situation. And again, you've got George Mason waiting for you in the Elite Eight. It also was more devastating because we basically won that game. The game was over. You know, you got to stay nervous until the very end. But for all intents and purposes, the game was over. They were up 5 or something like that with 40 seconds left and just a bunch of stupid mistakes and lost that game. So that was definitely more devastating. The other one was kind of, you know, it was a Cinderella type story.
Yeah.
Where you just want to win games just to be winning the games. And 2006 really felt like there was a chance to go somewhere. So yes, much more devastating.
Although the bright side I identified out of that is if the Huskies had gone to the Final Four, there's no way Brandon Roy lasts long enough in the draft to end up in Portland. So wouldn't have been able to see him for that period of time.
I guess so. Really not that big of a Blazers fan.
Yeah, but I watched him a lot in person. I mean, the game where he had the big game against Dallas in the playoffs is my single favorite NBA game, I think, possibly.
Maybe he would have played so well that the Sonics would have been smart enough to trade up and draft Brandon Roy, and this franchise would have been kept in Seattle.
Wouldn't count on that.
You want them being smart enough to do that?
Yeah, no.
Anything else about your trip?
No, I think we should let's talk about the Seahawks.
The Seahawks. So big win on Sunday over the Vikings, 41-20 for the Seahawks. And I was thinking the next day, just looking on Facebook, because I could not do anything after the game that day, considering that I started drinking around 7 a.m., by the time I got home, I was very exhausted. But the tenor in Seattle for the Seahawks is huge right now. It's crazy. I know that you haven't been here since that win, but this is the moment where people are most excited about the Seahawks right now.
That stuns me that this was the game that did it.
It was really strange. I think Percy Harvin coming back really excited people. It was kind of like, and the combination of the big win over Atlanta and then the big win over Minnesota, that we didn't play a close game. It was kind of like after the Tampa Bay, the close win against Tampa Bay, there was muted excitement. But now you're 10-1. The 49ers have lost 2 in a row. You've got the Saints coming in for the next game. It's all built to this point where we have a bye week too. So we have 2 weeks to be excited about it. But it's kind of built to this point where it's like, this feels like our moment right now.
Well, it probably should. I mean, the question is how much further it can potentially grow.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The bandwagon right now, I would say, and this is a good thing. I like the bandwagon, especially for the Seahawks. The bandwagon right now is huge, and it's just going to keep getting bigger, I think, going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why it wouldn't at this point. At some point, it gains so much momentum that, like, if you're not following the team or paying attention to them, it really feels like you're getting left out.
Yeah, it's
So.
strange. So, you want to break down that game for Sunday? How much of the game did you see?
I didn't see a single play. I was in the airport for a while during the first half, but the only games that they had on were Packers, Giants, and then Niners, Saints.
At which airport?
In Detroit.
Oh, okay. I thought you were still in Seattle at the airport. I was like,
No.
that is strange.
No,
Not, I was like, that negates everything that I just said about the excitement.
it's.
So well, to break down the game a little bit, since you weren't there, 19 offensive snaps for Percy Harvin, obviously his first game of the year, and then also the big punt return or kick return, which kind of changed the tenor of the whole game. It was a close game before that Percy Harvin kick return near the end of the half, and he returns it past the 50, and then the Seahawks go down and score. That was kind of a game-changing type play, and it was really what we were expecting of Percy Harvin. It's kind of crazy that it just happened immediately.
That excited me without even seeing it. Just seeing that pop up on Gamecast that or
Yeah.
Twitter or whatever that the Seahawks had the ball in position there when, we're going to potentially get some points out of that after letting Minnesota score late in the first half was a
Yeah,
huge
and so
change.
it really was. The difference that he makes in changing the game and just adding more and more and more points is kind of just like getting those extra yards. I mean, what he's picking up there is like four first downs.
And the other thing worth discussing is it's another great 2-minute drill for Russell Wilson at the end of the first half. He has been phenomenal in those situations this year.
Absolutely. When forced to pass, it kind of makes you think. I know that the Seahawks fashion themselves a running team and have a great running game, but when forced to pass, I mean, you think of this, you think of, I mean, there's a situation at the Atlanta game in Carolina where they had to pass quite a bit, and then also last year in the playoffs against Atlanta. That offense is insane when they have to pass.
Yeah, you see Russell Wilson really get a much greater rhythm, I think, in those scenarios.
So I would expect Russell Wilson for the Seahawks. This happens with a lot of teams where you start out as a grinded out kind of running team, good defense, running game, but you have this great quarterback who's kind of just evolving into being a quarterback who's really going to carry the team. So I'd expect this kind of projecting far out, but 4 years from now, within the next 3 to 4 years, I mean, I've already projected Russell Wilson's entire life. Within the next 3 to 4 years, that the Seahawks will be a team that kind of leans on Russell to get them down the field. As Marshawn kind of slows down a little bit in the next 3 or 4 years.
I think we saw that with the Patriots, where they won that first Super Bowl, where Brady was kind of, and I sort of hate this label, but a game manager at that point in his career. And they still often run the ball a lot, but Brady is the guy now in a way that he wasn't early in his career. And I think you'll see something similar with Russell.
Absolutely, that's what I'd expect. But the 19 snaps for Percy on offense, pretty nice. More than I probably was expecting him to have coming into the game. For reference, Golden Tate had 38 snaps. So Percy kind of played half of the reasonable snaps in the game. They went to the deep backups at some point once the game was in control in the fourth quarter. But a little bit more than I expected to see Percy play. And it was nice to see him out there and look totally comfortable and natural, I felt.
I think it was ideal the way that they were able to integrate him like that. And then I think you feel like after this week of practice that he's, pretty close to 100% coming into that New Orleans game.
And it's clear that he's going to make a difference when he's out there. You know, we were kind of curious to see how they would use him. And I don't think that they probably unleashed all the different concepts that they have for Percy Harvin. But I think seeing him in the slot is what they're going to see. I think that they'll probably try to get him the ball running more often and hitting him on a couple of quick screens. And we'll probably see that against New Orleans. It's an exciting time right now.
Yeah, and then also nice to have the full offensive line out there.
Absolutely. Getting the O-line back, and Russell Okung played a hell of a game. Russell Wilson was sacked only one time and not under duress like he has been for much of the season. But I also wanted to talk about on the defensive side of the ball. Minnesota's not a great offense, but they're not terrible either, having Adrian Peterson. And a huge shout out to the Husky or to the Seahawk D line and linebackers. They played an amazing game. And we always talk about how the Seahawks are kind of driven by the Legion of Boom in the secondary, but the linebackers dominated this game for the Seahawks defensively.
That's a big surprise. That's a shift from what we've seen. And I thought they did a terrific job against Adrian Peterson. You know, we never saw the boom run that I was kind of expecting all game.
No, not at all. I mean, they really bottled them up. Part of the reason that they might have gotten some longer passes may have been that they were selling out a little bit against Adrian Peterson and really trying to stop the run. But if you look at their passing, they were 4 for 5 on long passes for 109 yards and 2 touchdowns. And then underneath stuff that the linebackers would have been defending, they were 14 for 29 for 98 yards, plus two the picks that Bobby Wagner and Clint McDonald had. So the D-line and linebackers really, really stepped up in this game. And we kind of talked about how the linebackers are the weakest unit on the Seahawks. And this week, they seemed like if you just watched this game in a bubble, you would assume that the linebackers were the best part of the team.
I mean, that's encouraging to see that. And, you know, Ken Norton has talked about, I think, how he challenged the linebackers before that Atlanta game, and they've really responded the last 2 weeks, I would say.
Yeah, Bobby Wagner especially. I guess Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, and then Malcolm Smith came in at the end of the game and played really well also. But seeing Bobby Wagner play kind of at the level that he was playing at last season is really exciting, especially going forward. And also in a situation where their next game, probably linebackers are going to have to be defending somebody like Jimmy Graham.
Yeah, probably two linebackers are going to have to be defending Jimmy Graham, but.
So going into that New Orleans game, and we'll break that down next week, but going into that game, you really like to see all the different facets of the defense kind of humming at the right time. The D-line pretty much back in its entirety, and a good chance to kind of put pressure on Drew Brees, plus the 2 weeks off. Everybody's going to be rested. Everybody's kind of in rhythm right now.
It's hard to beat going into your bye week.
It really is. And then also on special teams, it was another week where the Seahawks allowed 0 punt return yards. I think they're at something like 16 punt return yards for the entire season.
And that's against a team that is near the top of the league in both kick and punt return. So a huge factor in last Sunday's game, and the Seahawks special team shined again, now moved up to number one in Football Outsiders rankings again.
Yeah, they gave up one long kick return to Cordarrelle Patterson, but nothing else. And so I was thinking about it, why their kick coverage is so good. It's partially, I think, John Ryan's a great punter, and I think that they have an aggressive unit. But also, it seems like they use kind of their normal skill position players there a little bit more than other teams do. You see KJ Wright, Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas often on that kick and punt coverage teams. And so you've got your stars out there, and maybe it's just attributed to their youth that they can do that and also play well on defense. But I was comparing it to another team who had good defense and bad special teams, like the Buffalo Bills. And they're not using Jarris Bird, Kiko Alonso, and players like that on special teams. They're just playing defense. And so maybe that's owed to the depth that the Seahawks have, that they can kind of rotate in and out. They can rotate Malcolm Smith in for KJ Wright if they need to. Malcolm Smith also plays on kick coverage teams. But I think it kind of owes to the depth of the team that they can use these guys in every situation and not have them just be playing defense and giving up yards on punt returns.
Two thoughts on that. I think number one, it's really an emphasis for Pete Carroll, and probably to an extent relates to his experience at USC, where you've got a much bigger drop off between your starters and your backups on special teams. And I think he had success using his starters in those roles. And number two, I think the other thing is you look at two of those three guys are guys who are late round draft picks, and players like that often have to make the team with special teams first, or they've had to play it at some point in their career. You know, Earl Thomas is the exception where he never needed to, but then they can continue to do it even after they've progressed to larger roles on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing I actually hadn't considered. Where Jarris Bird, I think he was a second round pick, maybe he was later than that. And then Kiko Alonso, who is a high pick for the Bills, they're both coming in and playing as rookies. They've both been kind of star players, so they haven't had to put in the special teams time that Cam Chancellor and KJ Wright had to do. I had not considered that. So going into next week, some exciting stats from Football Outsiders: Seahawks 7th in offense, 2nd in defense, and 1st in special teams.
I mean, that's really good. I really feel like, you know, for all the hand-wringing a couple weeks ago, the first 11 weeks of the season could not possibly have gone much better for the Seahawks. You know, especially to have only one injury that it seems like is going to be a long-term issue to a key player, that being Sidney Rice's torn ACL. I can't complain whatsoever.
It really is crazy how nicely, if we were to week one have predicted what the record would be at this point, I think we both thought it would be good. But the whole situation, I don't know if we could have predicted that it would be this good, where you have injuries to key players like Russell Okung, Percy Harvin, Breno Giacomini, Bobby Wagner, Brandon Browner, somebody who did have a serious injury though also. But see them come back right at the right time. You know, a lot of teams have lost left tackles this year, and they've lost them for the entire season. The Seahawks, I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, lost Russell Okung for a significant chunk of time and then proceeded to go 9-1 during those games that he didn't play in.
Yeah, you know, it's great.
It is great. And with the Seahawks' seventh on offense, I really think that there's room to grow there, which is kind of crazy that with them being seventh, second, and first, that they have a lot of upside in there. I would expect in the overall total DVOA and Football Outsiders, they closed the gap on the Broncos pretty significantly. And the Seahawks, it's been 1A and 1B the entire season with the Seahawks and the Broncos, but it's becoming even more so that, and I think the Seahawks might eclipse the Broncos in the next couple weeks.
If they win the next two games, I think they probably will, although, you know, Denver has another chance to play Kansas City and another tough opponent, but they're not.
Oh, and they play at New England this week also.
Right. So, yeah, we'll see based on the outcome of those two games for each side.
But for now, it's nice to have a bye week to be able to rest as a fan, take some time off, and give the players a few weeks and prepare ourselves for that huge Saints game coming up in 2 weeks.
I guess that means we get to focus on the Huskies.
I can't wait. No, the Huskies will play twice in between the time that the Seahawks play. They've got at Oregon State coming up this week and then the Apple Cup the following week.
We'll be done with the regular season by the time.
It's true.
Seahawks next time for the deal.
Before then, I wanted to talk, and we had a bit of a conversation about this watching the game. The UCLA game last Friday, which was, it was a fun game to watch. It was not the most devastating loss that the Huskies have suffered. It was kind of unfortunate because it really felt like they're pretty much even with UCLA, and then the injury to Keith Price sending him out, and then also just having the game being in UCLA, where some of the breaks went their way. But it was an interesting game to watch, and I also wanted to talk about Miles Jack, obviously.
Yeah, he's a notable player, isn't he?
Yeah, Miles Jack, freshman linebacker for UCLA out of Bellevue, Washington. Kind of difficult to watch him play, considering that he didn't come here. You would have assumed that if he hadn't gone to UCLA, that UW would have been his next choice.
And he is really good, and 4 touchdowns against the first UCLA player to do that since Maurice Jones-Drew did it against the Huskies 9 years ago. So that's pretty good for a guy in his second game at running back.
But I wanted to talk about where he belongs. So we had a bit of a conversation about this, and I think we were on opposite ends of this argument, and I wanted to bring that back up versus linebacker versus running back, what Miles Jack's future is at those positions.
I was on the running back side, right? I got to double check.
You are on the running back side, yeah. It's not going to be a fun debate if we both agree.
No, it would not be the case. He's a battering ram. Like, he is literally unstoppable around the goal line. That's the thing. Like, everyone was like, oh, the Huskies will have had a week to prepare for him, and Arizona didn't. Yeah, you don't prepare for a guy running over you. There's no adjustment you can make. You can't be like, hey, linebackers, tackle. He's enormous and powerful, and the only hope is to strip the ball, which the Huskies did, but never successfully turned it into a turnover.
That is the week that they had to prepare for him, though, is to know that you should try to strip the ball from him. I mean, I guess my thinking about Miles Jack is this weird – it's a weird thing that people do, but projecting him going to the NFL, I think he makes so much more sense as a linebacker, and I think that his future there is much brighter. If he were to play linebacker long-term, he looks like a first-round pick right now at linebacker, and he looks like somebody who's going to be really successful at that position for a long period of time. As a running back, I mean, how many bruising running backs have you seen go in the first round in the last 5 years?
I mean, there's definitely been a shift away from it, but, you know, I mean, in theory, we're taking a guy who has very little experience there and has played as well as he has, and he's bruising and extraordinarily fast. I mean, I think would it be unfair to compare him to Bo Jackson?
Oh, wow. I think it probably would, but maybe not.
I mean, another versatile guy in a different regard. He didn't play.
How is he at baseball?
I think he played basketball as well, but I might be wrong about that. I if you project him out, I mean, the fact is still the very best running backs get paid more than the very best linebackers, right?
That might be true, but I really think that there's a shift away from these bigger bruising type of running backs in the NFL. If you look at, so the first running back taken in this last draft was Giovanni Bernard, who went in the second round. So that's no running backs going in the first round already. And I think that despite the mistake with Trent Richardson a couple years ago,
That was giving
I
my
think that
counterpoint.
Trent Richardson is your counterpoint.
Yeah, I mean, he went third, fetched a first round pick in value this year, and he is literally not good at playing football.
Trent Richardson must have hypnotized people. I don't know what's going on with that.
That's a separate issue.
But so the running backs who've done really well as rookies this year, I guess Zach Stacy is kind of a bigger running back, but Andre Ellington, Giovanni Bernard, it's a lot of shifty guys who can catch the ball out of the backfield, who can make plays in open space, and that seems to be, and they're also finding them later in the draft.
Yeah, well, Miles Jack had a 60-yard touchdown last week, and he looked pretty fast on that.
He looked pretty shifty. The other argument that I have is that he's playing against the Huskies.
That's probably a more valid argument. Although, I mean, it's not like Tyler Gaffney really ran over them.
I
Gaffney
don't think
ran.
Tyler Gaffney is a particularly great running back. He's been hovering right around 3.9 yards per carry for a lot of games.
Yeah, but he's facing eight and nine guys in the box in a way that Jack isn't.
I don't know. There have been previous Stanford running backs who've done much better in those situations. Stephen Taylor is somebody who's done much better in a pretty similar situation and was much more successful than Tyler Gaffney was.
Unfair.
But I do think that trend is moving away from that. And then also, once he gets to the NFL, he's going to be playing against big defenders. He's not going to be playing against the Husky D line and the Husky linebackers.
That is true. And, I still see him as a situational guy at running back, probably in the NFL, most likely. I mean, he is going to be a very good linebacker in all likelihood, but I don't think we can guarantee that he's going to be like in a super elite linebacker. I mean, I think the opinion of his linebacker play has gone up because of the attention on his running back play. If that's, I think that's.
I don't know if I agree with that. I remember there being a lot of really good attention about Miles Jack at a game earlier in the season. I can't remember who they were playing, maybe Arizona State.
But this is
They were
also partially.
playing a game on a Thursday night, and he just destroyed people as a linebacker.
This is also partially we're in Seattle. People are very concerned about Miles Jack here. Anything he does
We
is going
don't like him playing well.
see differently.
But I do see, I just see him as a linebacker going forward and a beast of one at that. He's so fast, so strong. He can cover so much area. Obviously has pretty good hands. That is exactly what you're looking for in a linebacker in the NFL.
It's true. I mean, he's a prototype. He's good at any position. You could probably kick if you wanted to.
I wish that we had him.
I'd also wish that.
So speaking of losing Miles Jack, we want to talk about for a second just the future of Coach Sark, what we're thinking about him right now.
Yeah, I mean, this really feels like a pivotal next couple of games where he could be in some trouble if the Huskies lose out and end the season on a three-game losing streak.
Yeah, I would say that he's probably gone if they lose out. If they, let's say that they lose the game that they're probably expected to lose, which is at Oregon State. They beat Wazoo in the Apple Cup and then lose a bowl game. What do you think in that situation? Chances of Coach Sark being fired if he goes 1-2.
I think pretty low. The one thing is, I guess yesterday there was a lot of decommitting and this is all very fluid, but he's gotten some nice recruiting wins this week and I think that helped him. But over time, I think the reputation is going to start to build that he's a good recruiter who can't necessarily translate that on the field.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I guess this is kind of pivotal games for that. I still have faith in Coach Sark. I actually probably have too much faith in Coach Sark. I think that he's a good coach, and I want him to be the long-term Husky coach. I want him to be the coach of the Husky future and the person who builds the program and takes it to another level. We're still not that far removed from a zero-win season, and I think that expectations have kind of gotten the better of us.
Oh, really? With Husky fans? You think that Husky fans think that they should be in the Rose Bowl every single year?
Okay. But
And that's
it's
realistic.
souring things. It's making things harder for Coach Sark than they probably should be.
But I don't think he's helped himself in some ways. I mean, there's been some definitely bad luck this year in terms of just this was when it was set up with a senior quarterback, experienced offensive line, quality skill players. This should have been the year, but you end up if you flip the schedule home and road, I think we've talked about this maybe before on the podcast. It's a very different season. I think you win that UCLA game. You maybe win that Arizona State game. And I don't know, you might lose the Arizona game on the road, but you know, you definitely
there's a good chance they could have beaten Stanford if Stanford's coming here.
That's also true. So I think that was a big factor in it, and that's unfortunate. But I think there's also some concern about just the direction of the program. I don't feel good about the way that, you know, that Coach Sark has kind of become more paranoid. It's not the same openness that we saw at the beginning of his tenure that was a marked contrast to Tyrone Willingham. We're seeing a lot more Willingham-esque things from
him. Oh, man.
It's unfair. It's not as good as it was a few years ago.
It's true. Some of the energy isn't there. You just wish that Coach Sark was a little bit more Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish that every person I know is a little bit more Pete Carroll. I wish that you were a little bit more Pete Carroll.
I feel like I'm decently Pete Carroll.
When we're watching sporting events, I would love for you to be Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll does get kind of outraged sometimes, though.
Yeah, that's true. When I'm at games, I think it's a little bit better. You're a little bit worse in that regard. You're less Pete Carroll when you're at games.
And I'm more Pete Carroll when I'm watching games on TV.
We should have a Pete Carroll scale at all times.
About how much a person is Pete Carroll. This will be a really funny conversation if everything turns sour and everybody starts hating Pete Carroll. Because it's kind of the nature of coaches, is that at some point you're going to hate them.
I mean, I would never be angry at Pete Carroll. I would just be disappointed.
It's true.
Carroll was about himself.
I mean, we loved Coach Sark a few years ago, right? Coach Sark was the savior of the program.
Yeah, but he was
the person who took us to relevancy.
But that was primarily based on, like, hope more than actual accomplishments, don't you think?
It's a little bit of both. The victory over Nebraska in the bowl game, he had some nice victories in there. A couple victories over USC.
The fact is, the overall level of performance Coach Sark's first couple years was not that much better than Willingham. It was just that it translated into bowl games because of the fact that the schedule got a lot easier thanks to Scott Woodward, who also, by the way, is a little bit on the hot seat right now with the basketball team struggling and the football team struggling, despite the overall success of the athletic department in volleyball and apparently women's cross-country and softball and women's soccer and men's soccer, I should say, and a variety of other things. Those are the two he's going to get judged on.
Well, I suppose it's a complicated time for the NCAA. If they're talking about how, you know, these main sports, basically football, have to support all of those other sports, right? And that's the reason that you can't pay athletes in football and basketball. Then you also have to judge him on the success of those other teams too, right?
Well, that would benefit his chance. Oh, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I think that in practice they already do. I mean, realistically.
I mean, if you're saying that every sport is equal, it just happened to be that one of them makes a little bit more than one of the other ones, than all of the other ones, then you have to judge him equally on the success of all those teams. But it's also kind of a complicated position to really blame the athletic director for the success of the program. There are a lot of levels removed.
I suppose, but I just feel like, again, I don't think Scott Woodward is a UW guy in the first place. He's such an outsidery type. He's not a Northwest. He doesn't have a Northwest attitude. I think even Todd Turner did really fit more culturally with the Northwest. And I think that puts him in some jeopardy.
Do you think you want an athletic director with a Northwest attitude? What does that mean? That you'd rather be hiking than watching a football game?
No, but just there's a...
He'll be passive-aggressive instead of upset about things?
First off, the extent to which you're pushing things through as opposed to working to build consensus, I mean, we know that there's a certain style of Seattle politics. McGinn lost the election in large part because he's not very Northwest in his style, despite being very Northwest in his personality.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's interesting.
I think Scott Woodward is just kind of, he's an aggressive, like, get it done type of guy, and that is not necessarily, that makes some enemies.
Well, that's an interesting thing to keep an eye on going forward. I suppose his success may be kind of tied to Coach Sark also. Yeah, and those two will be pretty closely linked going forward. I do think that the kind of money that's coming into the program from football right now, though, it's hard to look at bringing in a new athletic director. I mean, you can't really give Scott Woodward necessarily the credit for that. I would say that most of that goes to Larry Scott, Pac-12 commissioner, but there's still all of the athletic directors across the Pac-12 are bringing in so much money right now. And it's even nicer because they're not paying it to the athletes.
Yeah, that does help. And the stadium was a big success, and that was a big factor for him. So he can maybe ride that as well.
Yeah, I think it would be very surprising there. So we talked about tailgating now from this last week. I mentioned that I was drinking since 7 a.m. Because of Emerald City Auto Supply closing, which we've heard about in the past, we have to go down to Seahawks games so early now just to get a parking spot.
Yeah, you were actually there before I got to the airport to fly across the country, which was weird.
Your flight was at 9:25 a.m.
Like a little after 9:30, yeah.
And I was there before you'd left for the airport.
Yeah.
And drinking.
That's a long day, as mine was.
It's so cold and so dark when you're leaving at 7 a.m. to go to a football game. And really, there's not a lot of energy down there. It's just people parking. I have to say, this is a very esoteric thing, but it should be outlawed, coning off parking spots. People go down there the night before and park their RV or whatever, park a truck, and then put cones around. That is not fair.
What, I guess I don't understand. They're doing cones to mark where they're going to tailgate around it.
And to mark other spots for their friends to park in.
So why don't you just move the cones?
Well, sometimes those people will be there. They'll be like one representative from the group there, but then they have coned off six spots.
Yeah, no, that definitely should not be allowed. But who's going to enforce that? It's kind of a lawless society down
It is a lawless
there.
society.
I think you prefer it that way.
The mayors of Third Avenue are the homeless people who live there, right? No, nobody's going to be enforcing any rules when they're just trying to sell drugs. So it's kind of crazy down there. But I do have to give a special shout out to the people who are across from us tailgating. So Chris and I, who I go to the Seahawks games with, it's just two of us, so we go down there pretty casually. We don't barbecue. We basically just bring a cooler and chairs and sit there and hang out before the game, talk to random characters who come along, things like that, talk about football, look at our fantasy scores, right? But around 9:30 a.m., it started pouring rain, and it was not particularly pleasant. We talked about going into the car and sitting at tailgating in the car, which is not fun at all.
Yeah.
And Chris was like, wait it out. Somebody will invite us to their area. And lo and behold, the person comes across to us, who is directly across from us. They had a really nice canopy set up, a big truck. They had a barbecue. It was a bigger group. And they invited us over to hang out with them. So that was very nice. And a special shout out to those people for being hospitable.
That's very nice.
And then also a strange situation. So while we were driving down there, Chris was telling me that he's applying for a job at UPS. And did I tell you about this already?
You did.
Okay.
But you're
And
the listeners now.
so the people across from us that invited us over, it was four managers at UPS where he's applying.
That is serendipitous.
One of them works in HR, and Chris informed me that he saw him at his interview the following week.
Nice.
I was like, wow, how did this happen?
That's really Seahawks karma right there.
Really, I was impressed. It was just a whole host of UPS characters that came up to us. I thought it was very good luck for Chris getting that job at UPS. I was like, there's no way you're not going to get it now. You already are a UPS employee, basically. I was there. I was like, I know nothing about UPS. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I could have contributed something. I've been to the UPS store a couple times in the last 2 weeks.
Oh, well, there you go. The UPS store. But I did have a dilemma. So those folks invited us over. They had chicken wings. They had those nice hot dog sausages. They were very hospitable, but they had a half gallon of tequila. It was Costco brand tequila, and I don't really like tequila as a beverage, right? This
Yeah.
is also before 10 a.m. that this situation happened. They were very aggressive on wanting us to share a shot of tequila with them. I knew that this would not sit well with the very, very dark beer that I'd been drinking, also that it's 9:30. But I felt like, in the interest of being a friendly guest to them, they had been so hospitable that I had to take a shot of tequila. Now, Chris refused.
Huh.
He turned it down completely, which is what I wish I would have done. But
You
I
sound
wanted to
very
be
like.
a good guest, so I took a shot of tequila with them at 9:30 a.m.
I think you do one to be polite and then call it good.
It was the worst.
I can't.
There was a chance that I was going to throw up after taking it. It was just like, my body was like, what are you doing to yourself?
Is that a
Like,
shutdown to tequila?
Why is this happening? Chris took a pull off the tequila later after, after we'd finished our beers. But they were very hospitable, so thank you again to them. It was worth it taking the shot of tequila to be a good guest. But at the time, I almost threw up all over them.
Now, did you tell them about the Pelton cast?
I did not. That would be a very strange thing to tell them about.
But they seem like potential listeners.
They did seem like potential listeners. They were talking. The person specifically asked me, are you a fan of just the Seahawks or the entire NFL? Which Chris and I determined was kind of a strange question, because most fans of the Seahawks are fans of the entire NFL, right?
I guess there's some bandwagon jumpers who may just be fans of the Seahawks.
It did occur to me that there probably are a few people who are just fans of Seahawks who go to those games. It's true. I would say that they're probably more bandwagon jumpers. But it's not like the NBA or college basketball. In the NBA, you can pretty much just be a fan of your team and not have to pay attention to everything else necessarily. You'll pay attention to LeBron and people like that, but you might not know about Giannis Antetokounmpo. But most Seahawks fans are fans of the entire NFL.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of inevitable the way the league is set up with one day a week primarily.
And then next week, so no tailgating next week. Well, I guess we've got the Apple Cup on Friday. But this coming Saturday, Sunday, Seahawks on bye and the Huskies at Oregon State. But I'm excited to talk about beer pairings for Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, that will be good.
I can't wait. I'm excited to talk about Thanksgiving dinner. We're going to rank our top five and then also talk about the best beer pairings for Thanksgiving.
Don't miss
it. There's a little future Pelton cast preview. And then did you want to talk about fantasy from this week?
Yeah, my team's really rounding into form. I feel like you don't – 2 weeks in a row over 100, I don't think you want to see me in the playoffs if in the unlikely event I make it.
You don't think I want to see you in the playoffs or the royal you?
Well, you in particular probably would play me because you're going to be the first seed and I would be the fourth seed if I make it.
I would be perfectly fine seeing you in the playoffs. Yeah. Let it be known. I would not be concerned at all. I've scored over 100 every single week. You have 2 weeks over 100 and you think you're hot stuff.
Well, I've got some developing depth. Were there any waiver claims worthwhile this week? I saw a few in this morning, but nothing too exciting.
There are a lot of waivers. Nobody in particular. I picked up Alex Smith as a 1 week. He's kind of been passed around a lot. Alex Smith is the fantasy village bicycle. But I picked him up to play instead of Russell this week since Russell's on bye. Really nothing interesting out there. I noticed that Hakeem Nicks was dropped. And I considered maybe he was an interesting option going forward. Then I looked at what Hakeem Nicks has done this year, and it's not particularly great.
Exactly.
I actually, this morning, just out there, was Anquan Boldin. And I claimed him this morning, and I'm starting him this week.
Well, there you go.
So I thought that was kind of nice. I mean, I have LeSean McCoy on bye, so I needed to find somebody to fill in there. It was either Shane Vereen or somebody who I could find out on the waiver wire. I suppose Lamar Miller was a potential option. But Anquan Boldin's coming off 6 catches for 56 yards and a touchdown. He's had a couple big games, and they're playing at the Washington Redskins, who have a pretty terrible secondary. I also think that – so I think he's a good option if he's out there. He's only available in 15% of leagues or so. But if he's out there, I think he's going to have a good week. Or he's actually only available in 4% of leagues.
So probably not in your league, just in ours.
It was a unique find. But playing against the Washington secondary, I would assume that the 49ers are going to be very angry after their two losses and they're going to be scoring. San Francisco is going to move the ball this next week against that Washington defense.
Yeah, you would assume.
But the push for the playoffs continues. Each week is going to be so crucial, especially for you.
It's very true. And basically two must wins the next 2 weeks.
And I can clinch the playoffs this week with a victory. Also, it would help you out if I won, too.
Indeed, it would.
Anything else?
Jermaine Kearse, concussion this week, so he did not add any fantasy points to his total, unfortunately, for the official player of the Pelton cast.
That's true. And the Pelton cast ad on the Pro Football Reference page of Jermaine Kearse is up now.
I have to check. I haven't checked whether we've gotten any traffic from it, so.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm sure there'll be tons for a concussed player who got zero catches.
He continues to lead Vic Ballard, though, 42-6 this season.
There you go. Nothing to add for Jermaine Kearse. And we look forward to seeing you next week for a Thanksgiving edition of the Fabius Paltonscast.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.